Proceed to hear argument in the first case on calendar for argument this morning, which is 25-2911, Nicole Savacante and Jeremy Savacante versus Daniel Nunez and Antonio Velasco. And we will hear first from Mr. Allison Main. Okay, so Mr. Allison Main, you don't represent the appellants?
The appellants are the city of Los Angeles.
We had a change of counsel. All right, so whoever is representing the appellants, please come up and identify yourselves. We had a change of counsel, so we're a little confused this morning.
I believe it's the appellees who had the change of counsel.
Okay.
So my name is Kyle Ellis. I represent the city of Los Angeles, as well as officers Antonio Velasco and Daniel Nunez. My time hasn't started yet. I'm fine with the 2 minutes of rebuttal time.
You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. So the key issue in this case is whether the officers are entitled to qualified immunity under either the first or second prong. The trial court erred in its analysis on both of the prongs. So in this case, two of the factors under the first prong are not in dispute. It's undisputed that the crime at issue was a severe crime in that it was an attack with a knife. And there's no dispute that Mr. Miller, the decedent in this case, was not actively—
Had they verified that the attack was with a knife and that it was an attack and that there was an attack with a knife?
So, Your Honor, the 911 call and the radio dispatch that the officers heard identified it as an attack with a knife, that the person reporting had been attacked with a knife and that the assailant was currently attacking a female victim with a knife. When the officers arrived on the scene, they couldn't see Mr. Miller's hands because he was inside the cab of a car and with his back turned to them, but they were able to identify that he was making these hammer punch motions that are consistent with stabbing. So when the officers arrived on the scene, everything that they saw was consistent with a knife attack on the trapped victim, Ms. Monks.
Well, the question for me isn't so much what they saw, but what they did. So we have the videotapes, the body cam, and I've looked at them quite a bit. I'm sure you have too. So they arrive, they turn their sirens off for some odd reason, which I didn't quite understand. They approach the car, did not identify themselves as police officers, did not tell the suspect that they had their weapons drawn or were going to fire. And then there was all of about 2.5 seconds between show me your hands and the firing of the fatal shots, with a suspect who was face down, looking in the other direction, could not see the officers. In that circumstance, why is this not something that a reasonable jury could decide was bad conduct by the police officers?
Well, Your Honor, I think this speaks to the severity of the crime at issue. So the officers understood that the attack was an attack with a knife. And when they arrived on the scene, they saw Ms. Monks physically pinned down by Mr. Miller, trapped inside of the cab of a car. They had very limited time to determine the circumstances, and the time they had, they were able to visibly see Mr. Miller making these hammer punch motions that were consistent with stabbing Ms. Monks with a knife. So to the extent that it would have been preferable had they identified themselves as police, identified that they were about to shoot or use deadly force, or taken any other actions to inform Mr. Miller about the potential use of deadly force, I think the fact that they did not do those things simply speaks to the severity of the crime at issue here, which was Mr. Miller attacking Ms. Monks with a knife, which very well could have resulted in Ms. Monks' death.
What does the record show about why they turned the sirens off?
The record doesn't indicate anything in particular about why they did that.
Is there anything in the record about that being part of general practice, either approved or disapproved?
Not on my review, Your Honor. I didn't see anything in record about whether or not they should have done it or whether or not they shouldn't have done it.
It is a fact that that weighs against the police to the extent that Mr. Miller would not have been able to hear the siren and know that the police were there. Although I would also hazard to say that turning the siren off would have allowed the officers to better communicate and better hear what was happening in the cab of the car when they arrived. So I don't know that turning the siren off necessarily cuts against them or cuts in favor of them. But there's nothing that I saw on the record that says that it's policy to turn it on or to turn it off when on arrival at the scene.
How about just the speed with which, you know, they arrived and then basically 12 seconds later are firing the shots?
I agree. It was very fast. 12 seconds is very little time to assess the situation. But again, I have to speak to the fact that the severity of the crime was an assault with a knife. And when they arrived on the scene, everything that they saw confirmed that Mr. Miller was attacking Ms. Monks with a knife. Given the limited amount of time they had to work with and the potential of Ms. Monks being in the process of being stabbed by Mr. Miller, they had to make a call at that moment to determine whether or not to use deadly force. And in those circumstances, you know, their judgment call on what to do, you know, it is just based on the fact that the crime was so severe and Ms. Monks was, you know, physically trapped in that car with Mr. Miller, who for all appearances was stabbing her with a knife.
You know, just one thing that's been nagging at me about those videos, there was a weird soundtrack of music inside the police cars. It's captured on the videos. What do you know about that?
I don't know.
You heard it?
I heard there was some music in the background. I don't know.
I mean, is that standard for LAPD officers to have music playing in their cars while they're going to a scene of a violent crime?
I don't know, Your Honor. One last point on the first prong of the analysis is that the Ninth Circuit has held that even a visibly unarmed assailant, qualified immunity might be available for police officers who use deadly force against a visibly unarmed assailant. In the Wade case, in particular, the assailant there was visibly unarmed and was charging at officers down an enclosed hallway, and the court granted qualified immunity under those circumstances. They didn't determine that it was constitutional, but it did. The court determined that it was.
Do you think that if they had not had sufficient information to believe it was a knife, that a deadly shooting was appropriate here? Hitting Ms. Monks?
I think if those were the circumstances, if they had not received a radio dispatch communicating that Mr. Miller was armed with a knife, I think I would be here arguing the second prong rather than the first prong. However, I think that cases like the Wade case would not clearly establish that even an unarmed suspect under the circumstances should not have been responded to with deadly force, particularly in these circumstances where you have the assailant on top of the victim in an enclosed space where the officers can't easily see in to determine what's happening, what the state of the victim is, and you know, whether or not the victim is even still alive. Under these circumstances where the officers have to act with, expediency to, you know, prevent harm to the victim, the officer's use of deadly force under these circumstances, I think, would be entitled to immunity.
Seems like there was probably time to do something else. I mean, we're not supposed to second guess, but there seems to have been time to grab him or do something short of what happened here.
It's possible, but qualified immunity analysis doesn't require perfection on the part of the officers. It merely asks whether or not an objectively reasonable officer in the place of the officers here in this case might have acted within that range of actions.
So the video shows one of the officers, I've forgotten his name, saying he's stabbing her, and then within probably half a second or less, the shots were fired. But of course he wasn't, because he didn't have a knife. And the district judge, the magistrate judge, put a lot of weight on this potential mistake of fact issue. What's wrong with letting that go to the jury?
So the so Officer Belasco is the one who said he's stabbing her. So there's two parts to answering that question. The first is that the instructions that the Graham Court has given us is that in these circumstances that require split-second decision-making by the officers, courts shouldn't second-guess the officer's decision in that moment. So here, Officer Velasco had to, within a split second, determine whether or not Mr. Miller was rearing up to stab Ms. Monks again, or whether or not he was backing off in order to surrender. He made the ultimate call that Mr. Miller was going in to stab Ms. Monks again. And it's clear that that's what he believed when he yelled, "He's stabbing her, he's stabbing her." So under those circumstances, the analysis under Graham would require that we give deference to the officer's perception of what was happening under those circumstances. As far as Officer Nunez, who was placed further back to the side and to the rear of the car, Officer Nunez should be entitled to rely on his fellow officers' his excited utterance of saying, "He's stabbing her, he's stabbing her," particularly in the circumstance where Officer Velasco had a better view into the cab of the car, whereas Officer Nunez's view was obscured by the side panels of the car and the car seat itself. So to the extent that the trial court didn't actually analyze the specific circumstances of each officer and didn't consider these factors, it shouldn't go to the jury under those circumstances, because the split-second decision-making on Officer Velasco's part and is entitled to deference, and Officer Nunez should be entitled to rely on his fellow officer's communication about the deadly threat that Mr. Miller posed to Ms. Monks.
So there was a knife that was recovered from the car?
Yes, Your Honor.
Where in the car?
It was on the floor of the car, I believe.
What does the record show about the size of the knife?
I don't recall exactly what the size of the knife was. My recollection from the pictures is it was probably about, in total with the handle, maybe 8-9 inches.
It was found in the front seat on the floor?
Yes. My understanding is it was found maybe between one of the seats.
So that was after the fact. It wasn't visible to the officers, and there were no stab wounds on the victim.
Yes, Your Honor.
Does the record indicate anything about how the knife got onto where it was recovered and how it got to there?
So I would actually turn to the interview testimony of Ms. Monks, who was interviewed shortly after the incident. And she was asked about the knife and whether or not Mr. Miller possessed a knife and whether or not, what happened with that knife. And she testifies that he did have a knife and that he tried to use it against her, and they were struggling for possession of the knife, and that I believe she was hit with the hilt of the knife at some point. So
my recollection is a little, I may be wrong, and I'll defer to you, but my recollection was she was asked in the deposition, "Did he have a knife?" And she said something vague like, "I guess." It wasn't like, "Oh, yes, he was trying to kill me with a knife." It was a very tepid kind of answer for someone who was supposedly getting killed, in the process of being, killed with a knife. I think she said, "I guess," in response to the question. Is that right?
Yes, you do recall that was her response to the detective.
Doesn't that seem a little odd for someone who is supposedly being stabbed to death?
I would probably put that down to the fact that the interview occurred within an hour or two of the incident. So this is a victim who had been beaten up by Mr. Monks for a period of time and was... She was.
When you say a period of time, you mean a history of domestic violence, or just a period of time in that moment?
In that moment. So I believe there was an extended security camera footage that I believe it shows that Mr. Miller had been beating her up off and on for a period of about 20-30 minutes before the officers arrived. I may be misremembering the exact amount of time, but she was. She had been, physically assaulted for a while before the officers arrived. And in the time when she was in the cab of the car when the officers arrived, she testifies that she was struggling with with Mr. Miller. And to the extent she doesn't have a clear recollection, I would put that down to the fact that she was in fact struggling with Mr. Miller during the process of being beaten by Mr. Miller.
All right. Did you want to save time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. All right. Now we will hear from Mr. Allison Ming.
Good morning, Your Honors. Cooper Main for the plaintiffs. So this case boils down to a single issue, which is mistake of fact. And that was the primary point below. At ER 77, the defendants concede that Miller was not actually stabbing Monks. That's not in dispute. The only question is whether there was a reasonable mistake of fact on behalf of the officers. Now, under Wilkins, a 2003 case, and then many other cases following that, like Torres in 2011, and a recent case, DeBronstein in 2025, the issue of mistake of fact is clearly, in the Ninth Circuit, a jury question. It's for a jury. It's not a legal question. That's important because we're here on interlocutory appeal. And Johnson v. Jones says that interlocutory appeals are limited to legal issues. Now, in the Ninth Circuit, the law is absolutely clear. Mistake of fact is a factual issue, not a legal issue.
Well, one of our legal issues that we can review is whether there is clearly established case law, right, such that the two officers in these circumstances would have been fairly advised that shooting the victim or the assailant would be unconstitutional. And I looked in vain in the district court order and in your brief for a case that said that. But what did I miss?
So I'd like to go into that. So the reason I bring up the jurisdictional issue is because going into the clearly established analysis, it's important that we take plaintiff's facts. So plaintiff's facts are that Miller was unarmed, and that's a reasonable inference because of the location of the knife. It wasn't just found on the floor of the passenger side. It was found wedged between the passenger side door and the passenger seat, and there's no reasonable way it would have gotten there from his hand. Then, additionally, he's the only one with knife wounds, and the blood that's found on the knife is his blood. So taking inferences in our favor, if anybody's being attacked by a knife, it's actually him. He's the only one with knife wounds, and it's his blood on the knife. Officers arrive. Within seconds, they order him with conflicting orders, but one of the orders is to get off of her. Within seconds, he braces his left arm against the steering wheel or the console of the car and lifts his body off of Monks. And Monks says he freezes. That's when he shot four times in the back. So on those facts, our facts, the ones that they're not accepting in this appeal, the law is absolutely clear, and it's why they don't argue based on those facts, because you don't shoot an unarmed person who's in the middle of trying to comply with the only orders he's getting, who is backing away from the alleged victim.
Well, what is your best case for these propositions?
There's several cases. First, I'll talk about two cases that have to do with unarmed subjects. There's Nehad, which is 929 Federal 3rd, 1125, a 2019 case. That's a case that starts with a 911 call involving a subject with a knife who's openly threatening to hurt people. The police come to the scene. They order him to stop. He doesn't comply. He doesn't comply with other lawful orders. He's shot within 5 seconds of those orders being issued. There's no identification. The police don't identify themselves, just as in this case. And the police give no warning that lethal force is going to be used, just like in this case. And it all happens very quickly, 5 seconds, just as in this case. It was actually a shorter period of time in this case. In Nehad, there was actually a metallic object in the subject's hand, whereas here there's nothing in Miller's hand. So we believe Nehad clearly established it, but also AKH Tustin, which is 837 Federal 3rd, 1005, a 2016 case, is another unarmed individual. This started with a domestic violence call where allegedly the decedent was striking his girlfriend in the head, and then he left the scene. When the officers approached him. He disobeyed orders and approached one of the officers and had his hand concealed in his pocket. When the officer told him to show him his hands, he pulled it out in an arcing motion that the officer thought was him pulling a gun. The Ninth Circuit again found unreasonable force, and that the issue of whether that mistake, that this unarmed person was pulling a gun on the officer, that that was a jury issue. So the theme here is that these cases of unarmed people being shot, the mistakes that officers are claiming justify the force, the Ninth Circuit is again and again saying that's a jury question. So, I mean, it has to go to a jury. So going forward, there's two other cases I'd like to talk about that I think clearly established the law. One is Casella, which is 841 Federal 3rd, 1081, a 2016 case. Now, just a quick note on Casella. The Ninth Circuit found for the plaintiffs on both prong one and prong two of the qualified immunity analysis. The Supreme Court reversed on the second prong. So I just want to make sure we're clear on that. The first prong wasn't vacated, so it's still good law. So going into the facts of Casella, again, a 911 call involving a subject with a knife. She was acting aggressively, hacking up a tree, acting very erratically. When the officers came, she started approaching another individual at the scene, Ms. Chadwick. When she was within striking distance of that individual with a large knife to her side, officers shot, fearing for Ms. Chadwick's safety.
Right, but here we have an actual clear physical altercation, right? And the officers could see that from the video.
They can,
I don't know if that sounds a little different than Casella, if someone's just in striking distance. Here there was somebody striking another person.
I would argue, one, the video is unclear what exactly is happening. I agree there's motions, but those motions could be him trying to move his hand to position himself so that he could get up. They could be him defending himself. There's some altercation, some motion going on, but I don't think the video is clear showing that he's necessarily striking her, and it's certainly not clear that he's stabbing her. I would just say, you know, Casella actually presents a much more dangerous situation than here, because you think about, in that case, somebody has a large knife, they've been acting aggressively, they're ordering this person, stop approaching that person, drop the knife, and the subject continues towards that person with a large knife in her hand. Compared to here, we have an unarmed person, and...
Well, I mean, but did they, I mean, they have a report of a knife, they see a hand going down in a way that's consistent with stabbing motions. Are they supposed to bet her life as to whether or not there's a knife there? And you got to see the glint of steel on the knife, or maybe even see it go in before you do anything. I mean, this is a tense and evolving situation. The Supreme Court has told us we have to take that into account. I mean, were they supposed to do more due diligence and risk her possible death?
So, I mean, I think the issue is that the jury needs to decide that issue first of whether they knew he was unarmed. Because they say in their statement, and this is what the district court below relied on, that they saw him raise his left arm into the air, and they were able to describe the fist of his left hand. They said it was clenched, and they described it in detail. A jury could find, and we'll argue at trial, that if they can see the details of his palm, how it's, you know, being held, then they would be able to perceive that he's unarmed.
Well, the district court did, for purposes of this proceeding, conclude that they did not see a weapon in his hand. So we have to take that as true for our purposes. So don't we just, assuming that they didn't see anything in the hand, that we then assess whether or not what they did was reasonable?
Exactly. So that's why I'm trying to answer your question of if this, I think in this case, if the jury finds that a reasonable officer would have seen that that he was unarmed, then there's not an immediate threat of death or severe bodily injury, even if he is potentially punching her. I don't think it's clear from the videos that he's punching her, but as soon as a jury says that there's no knife in that hand and the officers can see there's no knife in the hand, then there's no immediate threat.
Well, I think you're struggling with the fact that the videos, they're very dramatic, to say the least. And they're in a dark car in a fast-moving situation with a large man over a smaller victim making up and down thrusting movements after a report of a knife. and you can't see particularly clearly either way. But the point is the district court gave you all those facts, and we will too, because we have to. But even so, I did not see a case anywhere saying that it's clearly established that in these circumstances an officer could not use deadly force, and quite the opposite. Our cases routinely say if there is a probable cause to see imminent harm to an individual or an officer, you can use deadly force. And I think you're stumbling on that a little bit. And also, to Judge Collins' point, you don't have to see a knife entering a body before you shoot. There are many cases that say that as well.
And that's a good point. That's not the point I'm trying to make, though. The point is that if you can see that there isn't a knife, so you don't have to wait for it. I agree, you don't have to wait for a knife to enter a body. But if you can see somebody doesn't have a knife in their hand, then you know a knife's not going to enter a body.
Did the district court identify, I mean, because you invoked Johnson v. Jones, did the district court identify as a disputed issue of material fact whether the officers subjectively knew there was not a knife?
I didn't
see that in the order.
She
did say that a reasonable jury could find, and she would take as true, that they did not see a knife. But it's a further step to say that they reached the subjective conclusion that he did not have a knife.
I think she didn't reach that issue one way or the other, but she did.
For purposes of that, we don't have a Johnson v. Jones issue.
No, but you still can look at the evidence, and I would point you to the record that shows the officers saying that they saw him raise his hand into the air, and they were able to describe his hand, which to me, a reasonable inference in our favor would be that a jury could find they would also see that that hand was unarmed if they can see it so clearly that they can describe the grip.
Even though he said he's stabbing her.
The point isn't this, and this is a complicated part about the mistake of fact issues, is it gets murky when the officers are telling their version of the story. That's not what counts. It's not their subjective belief. It's what a reasonable officer
would believe. I'm just saying that was just on the video, though, that yes. He's stabbing her.
So I don't doubt that that was their subjective belief. What we're here arguing is that it wasn't a reasonable mistake. The Ninth Circuit has said over and over that the question of mistake of fact isn't about whether the mistake was an honest one. It's not about their subjective belief and whether they're lying or not. It's about whether a mistake in those circumstances would be reasonable. And we believe there's enough facts to make that a jury question, and that the judge agreed with us on that point. I wanted to briefly address a couple things that came up in your conversation with my friend on the other side. One is the record does indicate that they turned the siren off specifically for surprise.
Where in the record is that?
I don't have the citation for you at this moment, unfortunately, but I have that in my notes. And I wanted to talk about Wade a bit, because that is apparently their only case about shooting an unarmed person being okay. In Wade, the situation was just totally different. I mean, you had a out-of-control situation where an individual was refusing to obey any commands of the officers, and he was actually charging an officer, and they shot him. They didn't even rule in the first prong, but they ruled it was not clearly established. But that really has no relation to this case. I mean, there's no charging of an officer going on. It's a much, much less threatening situation. And then, Judge Bress, you mentioned, was there time to do anything else? And something the Ninth Circuit goes back to again and again in cases is that often the feasibility of an alternative course of action is also a jury question. So was it feasible to use a taser in this situation, given the circumstance, can be a question that goes to a jury and is often a factor in cases like this. And it's our position that there was enough time, especially because there were two officers, one of whom could be taser and one could be lethal. And then we covered the location of the knife, which is important. One other point is they made an issue on appeal of the district court failing to separate out the officers. And I just want to point out that that was not raised below. So the cases they're citing now about separating the officers were cited 13 or 15 times in the appellate briefs, but never below. So to hold her to failing to make that judgment when they didn't raise those arguments to her is unfair, and that's why we have the rules of waiver.
All right. Thank you, Counselor. Your time has expired. All right, we'll hear rebuttal now.
Hello, Your Honors. So it is undisputed that the officers saw Mr. Miller do a hammer punch motion. That's in the record. It's an undisputed material fact. It is also undisputed that they could not make out if he had anything in his hands or not. So that is also an undisputed fact. It's
could a reasonable jury find, as counsel contends, that they knew that he didn't have a knife?
I don't think the record supports that inference. As the trial court correctly found the only inference supported by the facts of this case is that the officers could not see if there was a knife in Mr. Miller's hands or not. So they are working on the information they had from the 911 dispatch that he was armed with a knife. And then if you look at the videos themselves, you can see that it is a very enclosed cab of a car. There's things blocking their view, and there's just no ability for the officers to make out whether or not he had a knife in his hand or he didn't have a knife in his hand. And given that they did see him making these stabbing motions, they had to work on the information they had to try to protect Ms. Mung's life. On the issue of whether or not it was clearly established, I think there are no cases that clearly establish that officers working under these circumstances clearly violated the law, or clearly exercising deadly force in a way that was unconstitutional.
Okay. All right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The case just argued will be submitted.